From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, helping kids in trouble with the law who have a parent behind bars. Joyce Dixon started the program after serving 17 years in prison while her two sons grew up without her. Also, we meet the former president of Israel, Chaim Herzog. He's written a memoir called Living History. Book critic Maureen Carrigan picks her favorite children's books of the year, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new CD series of TV themes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court has stayed an execution in Virginia. The scheduled death of Joseph Odell had drawn protests from death penalty opponents and even from Pope John Paul. Odell was sentenced to death for the murder of a Virginia woman outside a nightclub in 1985. Odell contends that DNA testing 3 years after his conviction showed that blood on his shirt did not match that of the victim. Virginia carried out an execution last night. Ronald Lee Hoke was executed for murdering a woman in 1985. The Federal Reserve's Policymaking Committee is meeting in Washington to review the state of the economy. Committee members will decide whether to change interest rates. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
There have been few indications the FOMC will raise or lower the federal funds rate. That rate, which helps set banks' cost of funds and influences loan rates, has been 5.25% since the end of January. Analysts think the Fed will let the year run out without changing it, but are divided on its 1997 direction. Some think the recent economic slowdown will continue and eventually force the Fed to cut rates. Others expect growth to remain substantial and predict an eventual Fed rate hike to prevent a wage price upsurge. Fed officials have expressed satisfaction with the current mix of low inflation and unemployment, but have voiced concern about the future. Some warn special factors which have helped contain inflation could evaporate. If the Fed becomes convinced demand for goods and services is strong, it could raise rates next year. This is Steve Beckner reporting.
Gunmen have murdered 6 Red Cross workers in Chechnya. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says he hopes the slayings won't derail peace efforts in the separatist republic. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports from Moscow.
The 6 were shot dead in their beds by unknown gunmen who broke into the Red Cross compound in Novi Atagi, a village south of the Chechen capital, Grozny. The ICRC has not yet named the victims, but a spokesman in Geneva, Tony Bergener, confirmed that they were foreign nationals from Norway, Canada, Spain, New Zealand and the Netherlands. Chechnya is no longer a war zone, but the republic is still crawling with armed gangs who have repeatedly targeted foreign aid workers, either robbing them at gunpoint or kidnapping them and demanding large ransoms. The ICRC has launched an investigation into the attack and has already ruled out theft as a motive, saying the people were deliberately targeted. The incident may well prompt other aid organizations to reconsider their work in Chechnya. The ICRC has said it is suspending its operations there.
Andrew Harding reporting. Weather forecasters say more snow is expected in the upper Midwest today. They expect about 1 foot will fall onto the ground by tomorrow. Heavy snow and strong winds have already created dangerous conditions for motorists in the region. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down more than 3 points at 6,265. This is NPR. Coast Guard investigators hope to find answers to Saturday's ship collision in New Orleans. More than 100 people were hurt when a giant freighter plowed into a crowded riverside shopping mall. Investigators want to know whether communication problems between the freighter's English-speaking pilot and the Chinese crew contributed to the accident. The investigators also want to know if the crew knew how to use safety systems on board. A 7-year study by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism finds that with problem drinkers, there's not much value to matching the patient to the treatment. NPR's Joanne Silberner explains.
treatment for alcohol abuse and alcoholism works about half the time. Alcohol researchers suspected one reason the treatment rate isn't better is that alcoholics differ in terms of how dependent on alcohol they are, on the social supports in their life, and their methods of dealing with problems. The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism tested the hypothesis that different treatments would work better for different people. They assigned 1,700 problem drinkers to either a 12-step program, a behavioral modification program, or a motivational program, then looked for matches between patient characteristics and treatments. They found only one. People who were more stable psychiatrically did best with a 12-step program. Other than that, it didn't matter what type of program people were in, so long as they were in treatment. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
A published report says the credit card industry will open a new campaign to reduce the number of personal bankruptcies and thus get more of its money back. The Wall Street Journal reports credit card industry executives will present a detailed plan to the Bankruptcy Review Commission today. The Journal says the industry wants to tighten credit standards, start up consumer education programs, and strengthen federal bankruptcy laws. The effort may face opposition from consumer groups. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joyce Dixon has two children who grew up while she was in prison. Now she runs a group called Sons and Daughters of the Incarcerated, counseling young people who are in trouble with the law and who have a parent behind bars. Dixon's program is administered through the juvenile justice system in Washtenaw County, Michigan. She served over 17 years for shooting and killing her abusive partner. She was released in 1993 after her first-degree murder conviction was reduced to second degree. While in prison, she became an accredited paralegal and the first woman to earn an undergraduate degree from the University of Michigan while incarcerated. After her release, she earned her master's degree in social work from the University of Michigan and became a family worker at a state detention center. Joyce Dixon told me why she wanted to work with young people who have a parent who is behind bars.
I think one of the hardest things for me when I was released from prison was to sit down and talk to my children and ask them questions about what happened to them while I was incarcerated. And it just tore me up. My children told me that, well, one, they were just ostracized. Friends and families, that kids that they had played with most of their lives, you know, they weren't able to go to their houses, and it was awful for them at school. And one of my sons, he dealt with it where he would go home and he would work hard and concentrate on his studies. But my other son, he fought all the time, every single day. And the kids were so cruel. And whenever they wanted to get back at the kids, at my kids, they would say something about your life doing mama, or your mama killed her man, or this kind of thing. And it was really hurtful. And my son said to me, there were places for kids to go who had divorced parents in school. There were counselors for kids who had been molested and sexually and physically abused. There were counselors for kids who had alcohol and drug abuse problems. He said, but Mama, there was nobody for us. They had nobody to talk to.
What do you think you can do for young people who have a parent in prison?
Well, first of all, I think that I kind of bond with these kids when they know that I was an incarcerated mother and that I know what they went through, what they're going through at the time. I educate them about what really happens in prison. Some of these kids think that because their mothers are in prison that they don't love them. They feel responsible sometimes for the incarceration. There's guilt, anxiety, all these grief and separation issues. And I allow these kids to express what they really feel. You see, what happens is, even with caregivers, and I don't think in most cases that it is something that's meant to be cruel or malicious, but caregivers say, well, if for those fortunate children who do get to visit their parents or their mothers, they say, don't go up there saying anything that's going to upset your mother because it's hard enough. And so these kids have nobody, they go up there and they can't t- tell their mothers. They can't express to them how they feel. They can't tell them what they're going through. Or, you know, my kids might have just got done fighting with a kid in the playground before visiting me, yet they couldn't tell me about it because they didn't want to upset me.
Would you think that that was a good idea or a bad idea? How would you have felt if they told you the bad things that were happening to them?
It would have made me feel really bad. But at the same time, I would have been able to at least talk to them, or they would have been able to say exactly what it was that they were feeling. Sometimes just to be able to share that makes so much of a difference. And yeah, when you're in prison, you try to stay away from the things that are going to make you feel bad. But the reality is, we leave these kids, we go to prison, you leave these kids out in the community, and they hurt. And kids shouldn't have to suffer so much because of our circumstances, because of the things that happened to us. So I think it's so vicious at what happens to the children who are left out in the community. And they virtually have no voice. So when I'm with my kids, when we're in group, they get to talk about how they really feel, that it's okay to be angry, that, you know, you can love your mother, but you can still be angry. You can be angry because you felt like you were abandoned. And I think that every time a mother goes to prison, that child becomes an orphan.
It seems to me that some kids have more reason than others to be angry. I mean, some young people might feel that they might be right, that their mother was unjustly imprisoned, whereas some other kids might know for a fact that their mother jeopardized the whole family's future to score some drugs because she was an addict, you know, ruining everybody's lives in the process.
In both cases, it's true. But at the same time, these kids still love their mothers, and they still feel like, you know, if she was there, if mom was here, this wouldn't be happening to me. If my mother was here, I wouldn't have been bounced from one placement to another. I wouldn't have been raped. I wouldn't have been molested in this placement, and I wouldn't have had to run away. And a lot of these kids do. There are inadequate placements many times. These kids aren't even placed. They're just left out there. And I did a survey with the kids in my group, and it was just amazing that with all the anger and with all the blame, and even with the kids who felt they couldn't forgive the mother for leaving them, every single one of them said, if I had an opportunity to see my mother or be with her, I'd want to.
Do a lot of people who have a parent in jail feel that jail becomes inevitable for them too?
Oh, yes. Yes. And a lot of that is due to caregivers or people who they are in the community with who tell them that you're going to be just like your mother or you're just like your dad and you're going to end up in prison. My kids had a panel discussion not long ago where they got to say some of the things that they really felt. They entitled their discussion, Everything You Need to Know About the Children of the Incarcerated. And one of my girls said that she had been told by all these people that they would help her and not to worry. But when her mother was incarcerated, they walked by her like they didn't know her. All of a sudden, no one helped her. And people kept telling her that she was going to be just like her mother. And she wrote, and maybe I am, because now I'm incarcerated too. Stories like this that just break your heart.
Why don't you describe Sons and Daughters of the Incarcerated for us? How long you've been running it, how many young people you see, what the nature of your work is with them?
I actually started working the Sadoi Group, Sons and Daughters of the Incarcerated, in May. And when I went in, I was told that there would probably only be one kid who would meet the criteria. And there were about maybe 23, 24 kids who were in detention at the time. And I told these kids my story. And when I got done, I asked them if they weren't too embarrassed or if they weren't afraid to tell me by show of hands how many kids had a parent who was or had been incarcerated. And at first there were none, and then slowly one hand went up. And when they got done, 18 of those 24 kids had a parent who was or had been incarcerated. And none of the kids knew that the other kid they were in detention with had an incarcerated parent, because in all their daily conversations and everything that they talk about, none of them wanted to talk about that.
That's really interesting. Since they were in detention themselves, it's not like the idea of detention or jail was foreign to them.
No. And it's unfortunate. And they felt that, well, I'm in detention, I don't want to be here, but it's not that bad because my brother's in jail, my mother's been in and out of jail all my life. One of my young people, he really has been given a bad rep now in the community. But nobody knew that when this kid was 9 years old, his mother was incarcerated. She was gone 4 months. No one helped them. No one went to the house to say, you know, you can't stay here by yourself. We're going to help you. This kid was 9 years old. He had a six-month-old baby brother. He had, I think, a two-year-old sister and another sibling. This kid was 9 years old. He stole food to feed his brothers and sisters. He stayed home, took care of them, washed for them, did everything he could for them. At 9 years old, he did this for 4 months by himself. And now people wonder why he's angry. And he's been in and out of detention, but he has been on his own. And he says, he said, I was forced to be a man before my time. He says, but nobody ever asked me anything about that. And this is not uncommon.
My guest is Joyce Dixon, founder of Sons and Daughters of the Incarcerated. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joyce Dixon. She served 17 years in prison, leaving 2 sons to grow up without her. When she got out, she started the group Sons and Daughters of the Incarcerated. So how helpful is it once you can actually talk to a young person about this? I mean, does that actually help them get along in the future?
It helps them. It helps the kids that, it helps the group itself, and it certainly helps me.
Does it help you?
Because it's sort of a healing for me, because I felt for so long, and I understand, I know the mothers carry the guilt of this too, because I did. And my son comes in now and then, and he's a guest speaker. And what he says to those kids breaks my heart, because I'm still learning about things that happened to them that I didn't know about. And it hurts so much when you think of what your child went through because you weren't there. My son said to me, he said, I was 6 years old. And he would go to a friend's house and they would tell him that he couldn't come in. And he would just stand there. He was 6 years old. He hadn't done anything to anybody. But kids are treated as if they committed the crime. And they don't want to do anything except be a kid. Or they don't know what's going on. Especially if they're younger. You know, and this is a group we really got to get to before they get into detention. See, what happens is when a kid like that, when a younger child is arrested with a mother and they come through the court system, it's that poor, poor little kid. It's a shame that he or she had to be subjected to this. Poor thing. But when they come back 6 years later, 7 years later, as an offender, they want to try him as an adult. Nobody really monitors those kids in the interim. People hope that protective services or someone will step in.
Is it often hard for young people to even get to visit their parent in prison?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Just to find the transportation to get there.
Well, one, oftentimes caregivers can't bear the expense because usually the mother is incarcerated at a facility that may be 200-300 miles from where they live. They can't afford the transportation. Oftentimes they don't have the transportation. You'll find in a lot of cases caregivers are people like grandmothers. They can't get there, or other caregivers who have determined themselves that it's better for the child if they don't see the parent. So it's really difficult for kids to see moms who are in prison. And the laws, some of the laws that are in play now, particularly with the Department of Corrections, doesn't help. If a woman gives a caregiver power of attorney or limited guardianship so that the state won't take her child, the Department of Corrections has looked at it as this woman has given up her parental rights, therefore her child can't come and see her.
Who took care of your children during the 17 years you were in prison?
I was fortunate. My mother was there. My mother was there.
And how old were your children when you were first in prison?
6 years old and 8 years old.
And what are they doing now?
My youngest son, who spent a lot of time making his books his friends, graduated from Eastern Michigan University. But my 8-year-old son that I left, who fought every single day, wouldn't let anything go, bitter, angry, nobody to talk to. He's now serving natural life in prison for conspiracy to commit murder. He was 18 years old. So for me, Sadoy is much more than a job. It's much more than a human services outlet. I know what I'm doing. I know why I'm doing it. I was incarcerated for 17 years, 120 days. Some of the kids I work with now, I can't tell you how I feel when I go in and see the kids whose mothers I did time with, whose mothers I drew up power of attorney papers for and limited guardianships and helped do the work for these kids when they were really little to keep them from being taken by the state. I look in there and I see these kids who think that their mothers didn't love them. And I get to sit down and tell them, I was incarcerated with your mother. And I remember when your mother would take her little pictures. She would cut those pictures out and she would put toothpaste on the back of those pictures so she could stick them on the wall so she could look at you and see you. How she would make little ceramic toys so that she could send to you. Yes, your mother loved you. And to see these kids just break down and cry because they never knew that. They never knew.
You were saying before that you think some young people feel that prison is inevitable for them if they have a parent who's in prison now, that it's just going to be a kind of a cycle that they become a part of.
Yes.
Do you feel that your son, who is serving natural life now, might have felt that way too?
Yes. Oh, yes. But my son said that he had gotten to the place where, you know, he just didn't care. He said he had nothing to lose. His father was dead. His mother was serving life in prison. He was just angry that he had no one, that he was out there by himself. So he was just out there.
So you were still in prison when he was sentenced?
Yes.
So you couldn't even go to his trial?
No.
But you knew about the trial.
Yes.
That must have been rough.
It was awful. It was awful. And I had worked so hard, even in prison, to try and be the best woman that I could be for myself, the best mother that I could be for my children, maybe the best daughter that I could be to my mother, to work so hard, endlessly, and you get there, and your son is now serving life in prison.
I'm wondering if you have any children living home with you now.
No, no. My youngest son, well, he lives maybe 15 or 20 minutes from me, and we spend a lot of time together. He's such a great kid. Well, he's not a kid anymore, but yes, we've managed to bond and sit down and talk about some things, but he's still scarred, and he still hurts, but he's just happy that I'm there.
Do you think you're becoming any closer to your son who's incarcerated now because you went through something that he's going through?
Yes, I do. I had a good relationship with my children before I left. And while I was incarcerated, I never stopped doing whatever I could for them. We do have a good relationship, but it's very difficult because his feeling is, okay, Mom, now that you're home, I should be home too. And I feel that way, but it's just really hard for me to visit him in prison, and I know I have to. But
it's hard for you because it means going back to prison for you?
Yeah, it's the clanging of the doors and the... Because I know what it is that he's actually living through, and I want my child home so badly, and it's a situation where I feel pretty helpless. He's happy for me that I'm home, but at the same time, he's really sad because he's not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Joyce Dixon co-founded the program Sons and Daughters of the Incarcerated in Washtenaw County, Michigan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, publishers of The Christmas Mystery, a holiday tale by Yostein Garter, author of Sophie's World. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the former president of Israel, Chaim Herzog, looks back on his life and the life of his country. Book critic Maureen Carrigan picks her favorite children's books of the year. And our TV critic, David Bianculli, reviews a series of CDs collecting popular TV themes. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, TV critic David Bianculli isn't talking about what's on television. He's talking about something that's on CD from television.
A couple of years ago, Ted Harbert, the president of ABC Entertainment, advised producers of most of his new TV shows to do away with theme songs. He was worried that viewers would grab their remotes and change channels while the music was playing. He was dead wrong. And when the theme song to Friends became a big hit, he admitted as much. The deal with theme songs is this. If you love a show, chances are you love its theme song. And if you hear them as kids, chances are you'll remember them all your life, whether you want to or not. A record producer named Steve Gottlieb realized this 10 years ago and released a series of CDs collecting TV themes. They were called Television's Greatest Hits and covered a lot of ground from the 50s through the 80s. Cartoons, sitcoms, westerns, cop shows, even soap operas and game shows. Now, just in time for the holidays, Television's Greatest Hits is back with 4 new CDs. Volumes 4 through 7, covering everything from Astro Boy to Ren and Stimpy. You can listen to these CDs 2 different ways. As background music that occasionally jumps into the foreground and makes you laugh or remember, or as a Name That Tune centerpiece for TV trivia. Here's how that works. Listen to the following themes, taken from the various new volumes of Television's Greatest Hits, and see if you can name them before I do. Ready, contestants? Here we go. That's Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. This one's Lost in Space. And this jazzy little number belongs to Night Court. And this one is from a show that's on TV right now, NYPD Blue. Some of the fun in these collections is enjoying full versions of the themes you recognize, like Seinfeld. But some of the fun is in the weird discoveries. Did you know the Beach Boys recorded a TV theme song for a sitcom called Karen back in 1964? I didn't know that. But I was glad to find out that Brian Wilson didn't write it.
She sets her hair with great precision. It's her favorite indoor sport. And by the light of television, she can even write a book report.
There are 65 complete theme songs on each CD. So with 260 tracks on these 4 new releases, chances are you'll find your favorite TV theme on here somewhere. I found mine, the theme to It's Gary Shandling Show, which I can't hear without smiling.
This is the theme to Gary Show, the theme to Gary Show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary Show? This is the theme to Gary Show, the opening theme to Gary Show. This is the music that you hear as you watch the credits. We're almost to the part of where I start to whistle. Then we'll watch It's Gary Shandling Show. This was the theme to Gary Shandling Show.
If you want to watch TV this week, the best thing I can recommend is Thursday's rerun of A Charlie Brown Christmas on CBS. But if you want to listen to TV, check out these new installments of Television's Greatest Hits. They're music to my ears.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News.
Thank you.
Well, that was the theme from the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Coming up, the former president of Israel, Chaim Herzog. This is Fresh Air. Chaim Herzog has written a new memoir called Living History, about his life and the life of his country, Israel. He served as Israel's sixth president from 1983 to 93. He's played several other important roles in the development of Israel. He was a general in the army, helped create the intelligence agency, and served as ambassador to the UN. His father was Israel's chief rabbi. But Chaim Herzog grew up in Ireland during the time his father served as Ireland's chief rabbi. The family moved to Palestine in 1935 when Chaim Herzog was in his late teens. I asked him about the state of the Zionist movement when he got there.
Well, it was the government of the Jewish people at the time. It ran everything in the Jewish community. The Jewish community, when we got to Palestine in the 30s, was about numbered about 400,000. And there was a British mandate, a British government there running everything formally. But informally, the Jewish community had its own education system, its own financial system, its own banking, its own sports centres, its own youth movements. It's every aspect of life, just the same as incidentally part of the Arab community, also ran its own affairs.
I think it was when you were still in the yeshiva that you joined the Haganah, the Zionist underground military organization. Why did you join?
Because it was the thing to do. I felt I had to. You couldn't walk around the streets there and feel that you were equal to others, or that you could get away with it by not volunteering to fight for your people. It was a naturally accepted thing. It wasn't something unusual. I wasn't being outstanding in doing this. I wasn't being very brave or anything like that. It was the thing to do. It's true that if you were caught training with weapons and so forth, you could be liable for anything up to the death sentence, but on part of the British. But people didn't. Somehow or other, one didn't think of it in those terms, and one did one's duty.
Because you were studying at the university in London during the time of World War II, you ended up serving in the British Army. And I'm thinking what ambivalent feelings you must have had about England. First of all, when you were growing up in Ireland, your family sided with Ireland for independence and didn't side with England. And then living in Palestine, I mean, England was
right.
the colonial ruler there. And, yeah. And as a Zionist, you wanted independence from England. So what was it like to fight with the English army?
You're right. There was a debate in the Jewish community on this issue in Palestine at the time. But the law was laid down by Ben-Gurion, who was our leader, a very great leader, who said, we will fight the British as if there is no war against Hitler, and we will fight Hitler as if there is no struggle against the British. And that's what obtained. We served in the army. There were 30,000 Jewish officers and men who served in the British armed forces all over the world, particularly in the Jewish Brigade, which was drafted then in Palestine and fought later in Italy.
Now, you were one of the people who helped liberate concentration camps at the end of the war. Could you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like? Which camp was it? Were you shocked?
You can't describe all the elements together. I recall there were lots of small concentration camps that nobody ever heard about and nobody's ever heard about since. And I remember the first one we reached, it was near Bremen, and we went in and I went with the general. My general was General Horrocks, one of the leading British generals at the time. And we went in there and we saw these people in the pajama striped I wouldn't call it clothes, it was a cover of their body, filthy, dirty, human, that they, one could hardly recognize them as human beings. The most terrifying sight imaginable. And it was so bad that my general went over in the corner and was violently sick. Later we came to the big one, to Bergen-Belsen, which was a very big concentration camp. And typhus was raging there. We had to burn down the buildings, the wooden barracks, because of the danger of spreading disease. It was something you can't describe. We brought the Germans in from the surrounding towns and villages and made them take part in the burial of the remnants.
Chaim Herzog is my guest. He was president of Israel from 1983 to 93. He's written his memoirs called Living History. You became president of Israel in 1983. What is the job of president in Israel? It's very different than what a president means in the United States.
Very different indeed. The president in Israel, he doesn't have very many formal functions. When I was president, we still had the function of creating, of appointing the prime minister on each occasion that there was some sort of crisis or election or whatever it was. In fact, six times I appointed the prime minister. Of course, the only worry that one had at the time was that, to ensure that he would have the necessary majority in the Knesset to confirm the appointment. The president is a very powerful moral force. If he decides that something has to be done, then it does get done. For instance, I was disgusted with the state of our health authorities, of the problems of the doctors, of the nurses, the salaries. It was terrible. And I went on TV to the nation and said, I'd insist on having a public commission of inquiry which will examine the entire system and change it from one end to the other. And the government agreed. And it took 2 years, this commission, high-powered commission by a lady, led by a lady member of our Supreme Court, and produced a magnificent report, ultimately, which has changed our health system radically. Again, in 1984, I felt that we were headed for economic disaster at the time. We had already 450% inflation. And so I approached both major parties and suggested setting up a national unity government. And to my surprise, both agreed, got together, and we had this special arrangement, which has since been copied by Turkey, incidentally, of rotation between the leaders of the party as prime minister. And, of course, a joint membership of the government. And it worked, and it saved the country. And within a few months, we were down from 450% inflation to 20%. Now, that's the sort of thing a president can do in Israel, provided it's not too partisan.
When you were inaugurated as president in January of 1983, you warned Israelis about a danger from within. What was the danger you were warning about?
The fragmentation within the country. I pointed out that while everybody looked at that time at the danger from without, the Arab armies threatening Israel all the time, at that stage we hadn't yet reached the agreement with the Palestinians reached a peace treaty with Jordan. We had a peace treaty already with Egypt. I saw a very great danger indeed, not from the external danger, but from internal division. There's division on social problems, division on economic problems, like in every country, on an economic approach. But there's also division on religious issues. And that is dangerous.
Back when you were president, then New York Times Middle East correspondent Tom Friedman credited you with playing the leading role in the fight to isolate Rabbi Meir Kahane, the former militant anti-Arab parliament member. Friedman wrote, at a time when many leading Israeli politicians were afraid to denounce Mr. Kahane publicly, Mr. Herzog repeatedly attacked him and his proposal for expelling all Arabs from Israel. Mr. Herzog, who also refused to let Mr. Kahane into the official residence, said, "I am the president of Arabs and Druze, as well as Jews, and anyone who negates their rights will not enter this building." Why were you outspoken about Meir Kahane?
Because I saw in it a great danger. You have to remember, we're a multiracial society in Israel. 20% of our population, approximately, that's about a million people, are Arabs or Druze. They are equal citizens. They have the rights of citizens. The Druze serve in the armed forces. We have several Druze generals who command the Israeli defense forces. The Bedouin Arabs serve in our armed forces. And they all perform their duties as good citizens of the country. For somebody to get up and say, disclaim an individual because of his origins, or because of his background, or because of his color, is unheard of. It's against all the ethics of the Jewish people. And I was certainly not going to be a party to it. I was glad that I took a lead in standing up against it publicly. And the net result was that I created an atmosphere in which it became very difficult for the extremists to operate.
Well, nevertheless, there still are extremists operating.
Of course, they're still
in Israel,
there. They're operating, and we saw the results in the rabid murder.
You've played an important part in your country's history ever since it was a country. What are some of the mistakes you think Israel has made?
Well, I was hoping at the time, and when we finished the Six-Day War and we took over the West Bank and the other areas, Sinai, Golan Heights, I felt that we could have moved then at that time. I made a proposal then at the time on the basis of a proposal made to me by one of the Arab leaders, the former governor of Jerusalem, to create an autonomy, a Palestinian autonomy, within the West Bank, and have it within the framework of an overall Israeli rule of the area. This was the proposal put forward to me by some of the Arab leaders at the time. Unfortunately, our government didn't accept it. We had a very outstanding foreign minister, Yigal Alon, who proposed the Alon plan, which was probably the most important plan that's ever been produced on the issue of the West Bank, of the territories and so forth. Had it been accepted at the time, we would have been living by now long ago at peace with the Palestinians, with the Jordanians controlling areas of the West Bank and not the Palestinians. But unfortunately, his plan was not accepted. And we dragged on for years and years. I think we should, at a very early date, have tried to reach a final conclusion. It's true that the leaders of the country wanted it at the time, but the country was torn, and they couldn't see themselves getting a political majority.
You know, some people say that ruling over the Arab people in the occupied territories over many years and ruling over them and not giving them many basic rights has kind of hurt Israel's soul as a country. Do you believe that?
It hasn't helped, let's put it that way. I don't think that we're as bad as we're made out to be. And the fact is that we've moved forward, we've agreed to change it, and we've signed an agreement in Oslo, and there is a Palestinian autonomous region which has been set up, and they are running their own affairs, and they are being helped by Israel to run economically in other ways. In other words, we certainly learnt the lesson at the time of how inadvisable it is, if possible, not to rule another people against their will.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be with you.
Chaim Herzog is the former president of Israel. His new memoir is called Living History. Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan chooses her favorite children's books of the year. This is Fresh Air. Critic Maureen Carrigan has been having a ball consorting with witches, tigers, tree-loving nuns, and a monkey whose hijinks have never gone out of style. Here are her recommendations for some terrific gift books for kids of all ages.
The best reason I know to give a child a book for the holidays rather than a vibrating Elmo doll is sitting on my desk at home. It's a stained hardcover copy of Grimm's Fairy Tales, and inside there's an inscription that reads, "To Maureen on her 6th Christmas. I hope you enjoy these stories as much as your Aunt Peg did." Thanks to the visual record of home movies taken by my zealous father, I know I also got a mountain of toys that year, all of them outgrown and eventually tossed out. But I never outgrew Grimm's Fairy Tales. The stories of Rapunzel, Sweetheart Roland, and Tom Thumb are lodged in my imagination. And so now is Julie Solomon's The Christmas Tree, suitable for readers 8 years old and up. Though a work of fiction, The Christmas Tree has its roots in fact, namely the majestic Norway spruce that graced Rockefeller Center last year, which was donated by nuns from New Jersey. Solomon has confected a rich tale of a relationship that might have existed between one of the nuns and the tree. When the story begins, narrator Jesse King, the again fictitious chief gardener of Rockefeller Center, is searching for a tree so grand, so impressive, so magical that it can stop New Yorkers in their tracks. He spots one on the grounds of a secluded convent. When Jesse inquires, he's told that all decisions arboreal must be referred to Sister Anthony, who refuses Jessie's request to decapitate her furry friend. Through annual visits to the convent, Jessie learns about Sister Anthony's life, how she was orphaned in Depression-era New York, taken in by the nuns, and befriended by her cherished tree. Years pass, then a terrible blizzard strikes. Though the tree still stands, Sister Anthony knows its days are numbered. After reading the scene where she surrenders the evergreen to a team of lumberjacks, you'll never snicker at a tree hugger again. Jill Weber's delicate color illustrations for The Christmas Tree enhance the narrative's hushed mood. In two stories for younger readers, the mood is more boisterous. Sam and the Tigers, by the award-winning writer-illustrator team of Julius Lester and Jerry Pinkney, is an updating of Little Black Sambo, which was written in 1899 by a Scot named Helen Bannerman. In this version, Lester and Pinkney have stripped away the original's corrosive racism and allowed the ingenuity of its young hero to shine through. If that sounds too goody-goody, let me quickly add that Sam and the Tigers is also wicked and silly and even poignant. I'm thinking particularly of Sam's infamous clothes-buying expedition, here transformed from a gaudy farce to something wise and wonderful. Sam buys a coat as red as a happy heart, a shirt as yellow as tomorrow, and an umbrella as green as a satisfied mind. Pinckney's accompanying pictures are just spectacular, so charged with color and energy they move right off the page. Those butter-churning tigers at the end of Sam's tale run fast, but curious George runs, leaps, and tumbles even faster. All seven of this nimble, cheerful little monkey's classic escapades have now been collected in one magnificent volume called The Complete Adventures of Curious George. In her afterword, Margaret Ray, who created George with her husband, H.A. Ray, describes how they escaped Paris together just a few hours before the Nazi occupation, with the manuscript of Curious George tied to their bicycles. I love that image of Curious George outwitting the Nazis. I feel secure in recommending Curious George to young readers because he's been my main monkey ever since I met him in childhood. But all I remember of my pre-adolescent reading is a dreary school diet of Silas Marner and The Old Man and the Sea. So I consulted a bookseller friend who thrust a copy of The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman into my hands and said, "This is the best young adult book I've read in 10 years." I don't have the expertise to second her judgment. All I can tell you is that my 11-year-old godson, whom I was planning to pass the book along to, is out of luck. The Golden Compass is a dazzling and affecting fantasy tale about a tough young girl named Lyra and her daemon, or familiar spirit, named Pan, who assumes different animal shapes. The intricate plot concerns nasty scientific experiments taking place in the polar regions and features appearances by witches, armored bears, and a female villainess who makes Cruella de Vil look like June Cleaver. The Golden Compass is the first part of a projected trilogy about Lyra. I'm counting on snapping up the next two volumes, even if I don't have children's holiday presents to use as an excuse.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Sherrock, with Tracy Tannenbaum, Barbara Bogave, and Lawrence Donahue Green. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a panel discussion on the Internet. Also, restoring wolves to Yellowstone Park. We'll meet the director of the project. He also ran a program that brought wolves back to the southeastern United States. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.